Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and we have another two-hour session of Zero Point Radio. Our website is at www.zeropoint.ca for Canada, and I invite listeners to have a look at my website and have a fair sample of my work up there. Unfortunately, I haven't had time to revise my site for a few months, but there's a lot of material up there, and it's not too dated. The main focus of this program is exploring the enigmas of human consciousness, and we compare mystical to mystical teachings about consciousness, and the origins of consciousness related to the human heart. And we compare that perspective with that offered to us from science, which views the brain and the mind as being centered in the head. So we compare the heart doctrine to the head doctrine. And in mystical teachings, it's explained that the process of self-realization involves the dissolution of the false mind, or the breakdown of this false consciousness system in the mind, in the head, and the realization of the self within the heart. And we draw from a wide range of mystical and spiritual psychologies to explore these concepts. So one is the heart doctrine, and then we also explore the zero point teaching, the idea that every human being has a zero-point element within them. And what I mean by a zero-point element, it's like an element that is so small that it disappears from view. That as you try to trace a zero something to its innermost nature, it contracts to a zero-point and then disappears from view. So the idea that human beings have a zero-point center connected to the heart. And this concept is taken from the teachings of Madame Blavatsky, a very famous occult scholar who died in about, I think it was 1891, 1892, in that period. And she was the founder of Theosophy. Okay, I'd like to today to open up the telephone lines early, because the last shows we seldom opened the lines up, but I would like to open them up today and give the audience a chance to respond to anything you may have heard in previous shows, or really to bring up any questions or commentary you might have. And feel free to not only talk about consciousness or your experiences of consciousness, but also to talk about the world situation and how these kinds of teachings have application in the world. Okay, I'll introduce, I'm Christopher. I live in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada, and my co-host, James Moffat, is in Toronto. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Chris.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Got a nice warmer day there?
Oh, yeah, it's beautiful.
It's beautiful here, too.
We have something which is not winter in Toronto. We have a very difficult, long winter here. I just wanted to say to Don, I can hear Chris so much better. The clarity is so much better this week in terms of just the sound quality, so that's nice. That's an improvement.
Yeah, great.
I mean, can you hear me better, Chris? Like,
I heard you fine last week, actually.
Yeah, well, we were doing programs for New Zealand, too, but sometimes I don't hear people that well, so that's nice. That seems to be a bit clearer.
Yeah, it certainly makes it so much more awkward when you can't hear properly.
It's a bit of a problem, but
I remember doing one show from New Zealand where my guest was in New Zealand and you were in Toronto, and the kind of gaps in there, it was very awkward.
Yeah, that was a bit strange. Yeah, that was the guy, the social credit guy, wasn't it?
I think. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the fellow who was in the social credit party in New Zealand, on financial reform and the monetary system and such. Yeah. Okay, well, maybe I'll give out the telephone numbers. Why don't we just open it up early, and hopefully we'll have someone call in, and otherwise you and I can just have some discussions of whatever we want to pick up on. Okay, I think the U.S. number is 877-876-5227. And the Canadian number is 888-810-8322. We'll give those out again at a later point. So I just got back, Jim. I drove downtown Ottawa. I thought there was a protest on Parliament Hill about the SPP, the Security Prosperity Partnership.
Yeah.
These people are meeting this week in New Orleans. And I went downtown, but there was no one there. So I don't know if that's the end of the protest. I don't know. I was feeling hopeless a little bit lately about the world situation and really quite discouraged. But I don't know. I have to find my way again in this crazy world.
Yeah. Well, there was an interesting article in Toronto Star the other day about this SPP, noting that, in a sense, how secretive it is in terms of the Canadian government's participation in it. And really, it's just, you know, the corporations have get a seat at the table, and everybody else basically gets shut out, and it's all sort of behind closed doors, and just seeing how, you know, Canadians are very, 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 if you look at the polling numbers, concerned about water and water rights, which is, of course, one of the main things that we have that nobody else has. We have a lot of fresh water. And that's something that's going to become more and more critical in the next 20, 30 years. You know, like, basically, one of the things that's not talked about too often, but basically west of the Mississippi River in the United States, there really isn't very much water, and of course that's where the population is growing exponentially almost in the southwest and the so-called Sun Belt. And then California, as Don and our friends in California know, water is a very precious commodity. There's a huge dispute between Northern and Southern California about control of water and water rights. And Los Angeles is built in the desert, essentially. The movie Chinatown is loosely based on the truth that in order to create this fertile land to grow oranges and all sorts of products, basically had to divert water because it's a desert, and the whole of Western United States, as I say, there's really not that much fresh water. Well, guess where there's lots of fresh water?
Yeah.
North of the 49th, and under NAFTA, the interpretation of the Americans, I think, is essentially is that water is not protected, and that water is one of those commodities that they have a right to purchase, and of course Canadians don't really want this, and so that was one of the things they pointed out in this article, is that what's going on with water rights, because there's a great concern that we're being sold down the river by these people, that it's all, the outcome's fixed, the Harper government doesn't have a very good record on standing up for Canadian rights and these things, I'd be very concerned about what's going to happen with that,
I mean, I see the SPP, I guess the roots of that were in NAFTA, North American Free Trade Union. I mean, it's really been both governments, liberals, the conservatives who have kind of supported that and climbed on that bandwagon. I think what Canadians don't realize, nor Americans, is how much this sells out countries to the corporate elites. It's like I've heard people talk about fascism is like a corporate state, and this SPP, it kind of usurps the democratic rights of the populations of the different countries and gives authority over all these areas of security and transportation and healthcare, all these rights. It gives it over to the corporate elites and really undermines the basic democracy throughout North America. I mean, it's really quite, it's a shame. I mean, that you just see it, how the global elites have really, they're bringing North America together just as they've done in the European Union, and I understand they're working at an African Union and a Southeast Asian Union, and
well,
then they'll unionize all the unions. And
there's nothing
have
necessarily wrong with that. In fact,
no.
I think that's actually would be desirable in a lot of ways, but the problem is that it's under control of corporate interest, and it serves a very small group of people and increases their profits. I mean, that's the great myth of globalization, that it's good for the average person throughout the world. I mean, it's precisely the opposite. I mean, there was a big, in Bolivia, they tried to privatize the water system there, and it was only because of the rebellion of the people, you know, people who are dirt poor to start with, and then they want to tax their water, you know, they want to sell the water. I mean, it's like it's in the ground, it's our water, you know, and these corporations came in and tried to gain control over the water system, you know. Very disturbing. Hey, speaking of which, there very, very interesting thing. I got an email from Democrats.com. I get all these emails from these guys, I think, because they signed a petition at one point to impeach Cheney. But I got a very interesting update from them that on, I think on the 11th of April, Bush told ABC News that he had approved torture of terror suspects, after 9/11. And what this email was pointing out is that they quoted Condoleezza Rice, you know, to saying that this would be a violation of international law, and essentially saying, you know, this is a criminal activity. Bush told ABC News this, and then it put this email pointed out is not one American major American newspaper had this on its front page.
Yeah.
I mean, here's your president of the United States is saying, I approve the torture of people who are suspects. This doesn't mean that these people did anything, but, you know, even if they did, I mean, you know, to hell with the Geneva Convention and, you know, to hell with human rights. We're going to torture people. And I mean, even in terms of extracting information, it's at best dubious that torturing people actually produces useful information, you know. But not one paper saw fit to put this on its front page or discuss this. Now, you know, this is how fascism comes to countries, is when you have such a culture where there's no challenge to these people when they do these things, which are so over the top. I mean, you know, Bill Clinton got impeached for having consensual sex with somebody who wasn't his wife, you know.
I know, that's funny,
And George Bush started a war, you know, well, started two wars, you know, has never, wouldn't form a commission to investigate 9/11 until the relatives of the survivors forced them to do so 444 days after the event, wouldn't testify under oath, would only meet with the commissioners, he and Cheney in the White House, with no transcription of what happened, tortures people, and, you know, he's still in power. How is this possible? How is there not, like, how is there not an incredible outrage about this guy? I mean, it's just the media's participation in this is just, you know, they're odious. I mean, it's just so... I don't know, it's just so shockingly revolting that, you know, like, where's the great New York Times, you know? Where's the L.A. Times? Where's the Miami Herald? I mean, where's the Chicago Tribune? All these supposed St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the San Francisco Chronicle. Like, none of these people think that this is a newsworthy item and might appear on their front page that your president is torturing people.
But I mean, all the corporate media are owned by the very same people who are doing these things.
I know.
Is how I've seen it.
Well,
none of them have addressed the truth of 9/11. I mean, they've all hidden that from the population.
Well, I mean, none of them really ever question the whole logic of going to war in Iraq, too. I mean,
then
you get these debates, you know, and the focus is on these trivial issues about this. He said this and he said that, and they're never about anything. They're never about anything substantive, you know. Does this person look presidential? I mean, it's the most moronic, you know. Like, you know, what would look presidential to me is somebody who actually stood up and said, you know, I think we really ought to look at this whole war on terror and question that, you know, the premise of this thing, you know. I mean,
you know, tomorrow night on CNN, I think it is, they have a debate called the compassion debate between Obama and Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, right.
It's so funny.
Yeah.
It was weird this week also seeing the Pope arrive at the White House and being in the States for 5 days,
Yeah.
My God, it reminded me so much of seeing kind of early Nazi Germany pictures of the Nazis all affiliating with all the popes and the cardinals out. And here it is again, you know, 50 years later, same old story.
Yeah. Well, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. It's very, very disturbing to see these things and to see how there's no meaningful debate about this, you know. And as I say, even if you had the point of view that, you know, that if you believe that 9/11 was a terrorist attack and that the United States had to do something, I mean, there's all sorts of civil rights that have been taken away from people. You should be concerned about that, you know. Like, I mean, as Americans, you should be deeply concerned about it. And it's the same thing in Canada, but it's not quite as drastic because we don't have a Patriot Act, you know. But we have our own legislation, you know.
Yeah, we have comparable legislation.
Oh, well, we have people yeah, charged here too. Like, you know, those 2 years ago, this so-called terrorist ring was apprehended, you know, and they put these young guys put their pictures in the newspaper and where they lived, you know, and they never do that with anybody.
And then they have a secret trial.
Well, they haven't had a secret trial because now they've dropped the charges against I think 6 or 7 of the 18 or 19 guys already, and the whole case is dubious at best, you know, and that's 2 years down the road, and now they're just starting to go, you know, they're starting to try these people, and then the whole thing just smells so. And then, you know, when it happened, when these people were arrested, these guys were, you know, everybody's busy congratulating the RCMP for arresting these people, and thinking, well, why don't we wait to see if they're guilty before we start congratulating? Oh yeah, great anti-terrorist action on the behalf of the police. And now it seemed to me like a big publicity stunt that was a dubious substance, to say the least. And as I say already, 6 or 7 of them have had the charges. They're just these guys who happen to be young guys who hung around together. I mean, they had nothing to do with terrorism. We happen to be Muslims, you know.
And I think the police also set these people up, like they kind of infiltrate encourage them. And like it's like the RCMP has this huge budget for anti-terrorist activity, but they never catch any of the obvious terrorists.
Yeah, well,
like really, they protect the terrorists. Really, that's how I see it. They don't serve the people anymore.
Well, there's the same thing in the Vietnam War in terms of the anti-war movement. There were all sorts of agents provocateurs in the anti-war movement who were often the most strident people who were trying to ratchet up the rhetoric and trying to get people to, you know, violate the law so that
was the police services.
Oh, absolutely. Oh. You know, the FBI had a whole con intel program to spy on American citizens and to infiltrate the student movement and the civil rights movement and later the Black Power movement. You know, I mean, there's no question this is all documented that this happened, you know, repeatedly. And as they say, at some point, you know, it's interesting in the States because, you know, there's this deep suspicion of the government. Hence, you have the richest country in the world in many ways without a universal health care system because there's this ingrained fear about turning health care over to the government. And yet, the same people who will, you know, stand for that position who don't want the government interfering in their lives don't say a word when the government's taking your rights away, left, right, and center under the Patriot Act and under this phony war on terror. It's really disturbing to see. You can just see how easily fascism comes to countries and how people are willingly give up their rights. I mean, the same thing happened here in Canada during the FLQ crisis in the early 1970s. You know, we had martial law in this country because one guy died and another guy was kidnapped. You know, two people, and the government imposed martial law. And everybody said, "Yeah, great." You know, you now have your civil liberty suspended. And it wasn't the people out of most people. I mean, I had a friend who was on Parliament Hill protesting it, and I mean, good Lord, you know, the guy was lucky to escape with his life, basically. You know, it's you know, years afterwards, this is Trudeau too, who did it, who believed in the just society and was an advocate for individual rights. It was kind of ironic, to say the least. But all you have to do is scare people, and you know, it's so easy to manipulate them once they're scared. And as they say, what strikes me more and more on a societal level is that I see deep parallels between the whole war on terror and terrorism and the witchcraft craze in Europe in the Middle Ages essentially is that you create this enemy at the gates, which is about to overwhelm you, and then you do everything to keep reminding people of this, and all out of proportion to any real threat, and then you just manipulate them. And I mean, it was the church in the Middle Ages, and now it's the government. There was an interesting study that came out, was published in the New York Times, where it shows that more people may die of health problems caused by worrying about terrorism than actually from terrorism. That they had studied people who were prone to, who after 9/11, who were prone to kind of exaggerating the personal threat to them, and who developed all sorts of heart problems because they thought terrorists were going to strike them again. Kind of ironic, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean that day of 9/11. I mean, how horrifying that must have been for the people, not only of New York, but particularly of New York. I can't imagine such a horrendous thing happening. You know,
no, it was terrifying. You know?
I mean, just around the world. I mean, I think around the world, people's hearts opened up to Americans. You know, and just how could this happen to America? You know. I mean, it's horrendous, yeah. And then this kind of continually they're create. I mean, no one makes any serious effort to capture the real criminals anyway. I mean, they just get scot-free. I mean, CIA, I mean, they spend billions and billions of dollars on police and intelligence services and everything like this. But when do they ever capture anyone who does any major crime?
Well,
the Kennedy assassination, the other Kennedy or King, they never catch anyone.
Yeah, well.
They always end up having commissions. And
I don't think
that commissions are complete frauds, like the 9/11.
I don't think anybody ever caught the real murderers in 9/11. That's what's so disturbing about it. It's the greatest mass murder in the history of the United States, and a truly horrific event. And yet, this goes again to spending money. But this is really interesting. That this is a question that to me, 9/11, when I first heard sort of the conspiracy theories, so quote unquote, and I hate that term because it's so loaded and isn't really a proper term, but I kind of dismissed them out of hand, just thought, no. But what bothered me from the day that this happened was, here you have the greatest military force in the history of humankind in the United States, and you have this Air Force with these planes that fly at incredible speeds, and the whole Eastern Seaboard is full of military bases. I mean, they're everywhere in the Eastern Seaboard, and you have planes, fighters that'll be scrambled under standard Federal Aviation Authority protocols. If somebody goes off course or doesn't respond, or there's a suspected hijack of an aircraft, fighters are routinely scrambled from Air Force bases. Where were they on 9/11? And then you start to read the criticisms of the 9/11 account, and you find out that this is where David Ray Griffin's books are really good. He goes through the American military has told three different versions of what happened on 9/11, and about the timelines of what happened, what people were told, and what actions were taken, and they contradict one another. And he, in his book examining the 9/11 Commission report called Omissions and Distortions, he takes all of these different accounts and he compares and contrasts them. And it strikes me, it's so similar to the critics of the Warren Report, is that if you really sit down and you look at an informed appreciation of these reports, somebody who doesn't have an invested interest in saying, that they got to the bottom of things, you realize that what's in common between the Warren Commission and the 9/11 Commission is that they start with a conclusion and everything is geared to uphold that conclusion, and there's a gross ignorance of evidence, gross active ignoring of evidence and distortion of perspectives, so that of course they could come to the conclusion that they started with because they ignore everything that contradicts that. But there's such glaring errors and omissions, that's the subtitle of David Ray Griffin's book, Omissions and Distortions, that I can't see how any open-minded person could read this and not at least be disturbed by the what he points out. Like, as I say, he's the first person I read, the first critic I read, and I read him because I know his work as a theologian and a scholar of science. He's somebody whose work I read, academic work I really admire. I think he's a very smart guy, a very interesting guy.
Oh, you knew of him before?
Oh, yeah, I've read a couple of his books. Like, he's into Alfred North Whitehead and process philosophy and is interested in the paranormal and has written very, very interesting work. What's interesting in his work is that he gets all around the mystical and esoteric perspective but never brings it to bear on what he's saying, and it fits so nicely with what he's saying. It's interesting that he doesn't kind of see it, but he's a very interesting guy. And then I read his book, The New Pearl Harbor, which is looks at what happened on 9/11 with an open mind and says that there are varying degrees in his mind of complicity by the American government in this, and you have to make up your mind. We don't really know all the facts, but depending on how you interpret things, you could say, well, at the very least, the American government was negligent, or you could say that the American government was complicit, or you could say that the American government was an active participant in what happened on 9/11. And he leaves it open-ended. He says, you know, I don't know the answers, but I think there are questions that haven't been asked and that need to be asked. And again, that's what I'd say about the 9/11 Commission. Like, I can imagine people listening to us just saying, well, you guys are, you know, full of it, and you're exaggerating all this. And, well, I would just challenge anybody to read these things with an open mind. I would say start with David Ray Griffin's work and read some of the other critics of the 9/11 Commission and watch the movie Loose Change and watch some of the films that have been made. And then, you know, I fail to see how anybody could approach this with an open mind and not be incredibly disturbed, you know. Like, as I say, I have no vested interest in arguing for this point of view. I wish I didn't believe this. I would much rather believe the
original story.
I'd like to believe there was a bunch of bad Muslims, you know, who want to blow things up and hate the United States. It's much easier. It's like, you know, there's no cognitive dissonance in it. But, like, as I say, my original question was, and again, I'll ask it, where the hell was the American military on the day that this happened? And then in Griffin's book on the 9/11 Commission report, they're talking about what the 9/11 Commission said. You know, there's this whole controversy as to whether or not an aircraft actually struck the Pentagon or whether it was a missile, eh? And actually, I saw something the film No End in Sight, which is about Iraq, which I highly recommend that everybody see. That's a documentary. It won the Academy Award for Best Documentary.
Wow. Was that this year?
Yes. Yeah. It's called No End in Sight. And it's an interview with, that's a very, very good film. It's an interview with many of the people who were actively involved in Iraq and the decision to go to war in Iraq, but also this one guy, a colonel, I think his name is Hughes, Colonel Hughes, who was really interesting, who was in Iraq and is very disillusioned with what happened there and tells a story as to, you know, how the wrong decisions were repeatedly made. But in that, there's an actual picture of the whatever it was striking the Pentagon. There's a little bit of a film in that film. I don't know where they got this from. They said, I think, from a security camera, but my impression was that all that footage had been confiscated. Anyway, it happened so fast that it doesn't seem possible. It could have been an aircraft, eh? Like, it just doesn't seem like there. But anyway.
Into a 14-foot hole.
Well, yeah, but anyway, at the very least, what's really hilarious is that in the 9/11 Commission, and this is how bizarre, you know, when you read these explanations and you have to read them with, you know, as I say, if you read them with an open mind, in the 9/11 Commission, one of the things they say is, well, you know, they're talking about this plane hitting the Pentagon, and they said, well, that the plane had turned off its transponder so radar couldn't detect it. Now, wait a minute. That's true for normal civil aviation radar. They use the transponder. They track the transponder, and when a transponder is turned off, you lose, you know, sight of the aircraft on the radar screens. But Are you trying to tell me, is this, as David Ray Griffin says, is like the military has a rather more sophisticated radar system. If somebody's going to attack the United States, they're not going to turn a transponder on a bomber or on a guided missile, you know? I mean, they don't give you a tracking device to let you know it's coming. So they actually have a little bit more sophisticated radar there. And as he points out, of all the places in the world to be struck by an aircraft or a missile, how is the Pentagon, which just got anti-aircraft and anti-missile batteries protecting it, how was it struck? I mean, it just seems so, to me, like that's a very disturbing question. I was like, how did this happen? You know, and they, as I say, the explanation, oh, well, they turned the transponder off so they didn't know where the aircraft was. I was, come on. You know, I mean, that's just so ludicrous. It's like, and I mean, there's...
It's funny. To me, I think what I find the absolutely most convincing aspect of it is the idea, how can anyone on second thought think that two buildings like that are going to collapse in the way they did at free fall speed? And I just heard on the internet, I watched a video the other day where the recording of the fireman in the South Tower who said all they needed were, there were only two more isolated spots of fire and they needed two more hoses up there. And they almost had put the fires out in there. There was no, and how can people possibly believe that those buildings came down in that manner?
Well,
due to what? Most of the gas in the airplanes was exploded on impact or very immediately afterwards. And the flames, the fires were all just smoking, so they weren't burning hot. They couldn't possibly have melted the steel.
Well, jet fuel doesn't burn hot enough to melt steel.
No,
that's,
it doesn't.
That's the first
especially
problem.
Especially the steel
second
of those
problem,
buildings.
Those buildings were specifically built to withstand an aircraft hitting them. Third problem is that the way they fell down, they pancaked as if they were, as if their charges were set off and demolished. Fourth problem is there were multiple witnesses who were in the building, firefighters, police, a guy that Bush gave a medal to, who was,
Rodriguez.
Who all heard multiple explosions in the building.
Yeah.
The people heard them. Fourth problem is, why did the World Trade Center building across the street, which had a minor fire in it, why did it collapse? I mean, there's just so many inconsistencies in the story. I think it was Popular Mechanics magazine.
Yeah, it was. It did cover-up on it for
them. David Ray Griffin wrote a whole book replying to that, eh? He's written another book saying, and the big thing is that there's never been a steel structures skyscraper anywhere in the world that's caught on fire, that's collapsed. One burned for like some place, I think, in South America, I think in Rio or someplace, burned for something like 18 or 19 hours and didn't collapse.
Yeah.
This was like 43 minutes, so 34 minutes, something like that. It's like, and all of a sudden the building falls down.
It just astonishes me that here we are in modern times. It's like this, I think to believe that the Osama bin Laden story is like a delusional system, that this has been intentionally inculcated in people, is this kind of delusional scenario of what happened. And people it's interesting to look at the American psyche. I mean, it's like it's schizophrenic, split mind. Like, no one with any intelligence really can look at the evidence and not realize that there's foul play here, that this, we've been lied to. How can anyone believe it? And then as a nation, and how the corporate media they've been such an integral part of this scheme, for the past 50 years or so. It's an astonishing... can you hear me? Sorry, my phone seems to be cutting out or something. It's absolutely an astonishing thing, like this huge split in the American psyche between like the reality versus this delusional system. And people, they're so weakened, there's so much disinformation, and it's like people can't see truth anymore. Like they can't see something that is so obvious.
But then the other side of it is, and this is what I can kind of have a difficult time processing, is then I read all these polls and I find out, and much to my astonishment, that, you know, that in one of Griffin's books he says that, you know, even like after a couple of years after 9/11, like 52% of New Yorkers didn't believe that the government was telling the truth about what had happened in 9/11. And then, you know, you read another poll and it's like, you know, a huge percentage of Americans don't believe the story. So how come nobody ever talks about everything that's followed in the last 7 years in the war on terror, you know, war in Afghanistan, war in Iraq, you know, Abu Ghraib, torture, suspension
yeah.
of civil liberties, passage of the Patriot Act, you know,
yeah.
To your telephone company, happily turning over your records to the government to see who you're talking to, the government having the authority to find out what books you checked out of a library.
How come
nobody wants to discuss that? I don't give a damn about Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama's little, you know, personal animus between one another. It's like, you know, these silly, stupid arguments they're having, and John McCain, you know, singing bomb, 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 bomb around. I want somebody.
Isn't that disgusting? Right?
I want to hear somebody say, you know, given that everything that's happened in the last 7 years is directly attributable to the fact that they had the biggest mass murder in the history of the United States. Why don't we revisit 9/11 and find out what the hell really happened? You know, like
yeah.
I mean, we have a president, as they say, who lied and took a country to war, and I mean, you know, in my mind, with the complicity and with the encouragement of the media, because it was so obvious,
yeah.
it was so obvious that what he was saying was completely irrational and completely idiotic. The connection between Al Qaeda and between the Saddam Hussein was completely bogus, and everybody with a brain in their head knew it. And yet, you know, here we are 7 years later. The cost of this war is now up to, it's going to be like something is projected to be like $3 trillion, the war in Iraq.
Yeah.
I mean, and 40 or 50 million Americans don't have health coverage, you know. There's
yeah.
fewer and fewer jobs, you know. The middle class.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of their scheme is to get rid of the middle class because they want to bring all these things over from China and to enslave the middle class of America.
Well, I don't even know if they want to slave them. I just think that they just don't care about them, and they just bleed people, you know? Like, I mean,
yeah.
you have to have them to tax them. But, you know, it's like Noam Chomsky says about, you know, the average person's role in all of this is to pay for it. You know,
yeah.
exactly. You know, is to pay for it through their taxes. I mean, at some point, somebody's got to stand up and start saying, like, you know, we got all these planes and you know, all these battles, all these ships and aircraft carriers, and we got this great army, and you know, are we really actually any safer? I mean, wouldn't we be better off with health care? You know, like,
yeah.
wouldn't we be better off with inner cities that weren't war zones? You wouldn't we be better off with an educational system that was available to every American and gave every American a real opportunity to better themselves? Wouldn't we be better off to address some of our own problems instead of, you know, going around the world trying to clean up all these messes that our government basically gets us into, and then, you know, you send people out to die for this. You know, young American men and women in the front.
I know,
forces.
It's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking.
And then, you know, they come home and they're ignored, you know. Shouldn't
yeah.
we have better veterans' hospitals? Shouldn't we have better care for the people who actually put their lives on the line, unlike certain people during the Vietnam War who had other priorities, Dick Cheney, or evaded service in the National Guard, George Bush? You know, like, I mean, it's just like, you know, wake up, people, you know, that's my message, is like, you got to wake up to these criminals, you know, like, I mean, I just, it just, that thing about, you know, Bush comes out and says, oh, yeah, I ordered the torture, and it doesn't even get on the front page of a major American newspaper. I mean,
yeah.
we're doomed, you know,
yeah.
we're certainly doomed, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, on some level, it's like, I'm not shocked, because nothing shocks me anymore, but at the same time, it's like, thank God for the internet, people can exchange information and that there are alternative voices and alternative organizations like BBS Radio, because, boy, if you're looking to NBC, ABC, CNN, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, to provide you with information. Boy, if you believe what you read in that, you know, I got some swampland in Florida that I'd like to sell you, because it's just complete manipulation and complete distortion.
Yeah.
Do you get the impression?
But I mean, there must be huge numbers of people who that is their news source, like who watch the corporate media. I mean, it's like there's millions of people waking up, but then there are absolute millions of people who have just bought into the whole thing.
Well, yeah. And it was the same during the Vietnam War, you know, I mean, and it was the same really. I mean, you go back to the McCarthy era and you know, how people were manipulated and fearful of communists, you know, and how McCarthy basically just bluffed people by saying, you know, there are X number of communists. I have here in my pocket a list of communists in the State Department, you know, communists in the military. And it's like, you know, he didn't have any list, you know, he was just, but nobody would call him on it because they're all so afraid to be, I don't want to be soft on communism. Well, now now nobody wants to be soft on terrorism. You know, they don't want to be unpatriotic. I mean, you know, that's a word too. Is that, you know, people talk all the time about patriotism. Well, there's a difference between patriotism and between nationalism. They're two different things. You know, patriotism is to me, like, if you're a patriotic to the American Constitution, you'd stand up for the Bill of Rights and for the Constitution, you know, not for George Bush.
Yeah,
you know?
No, the real patriots are the people in the 9/11 truth movement, and you know, these are the real patriots.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't the oath of office in the military to protect the country against enemies
foreign
and domestic?
Yeah.
So we've always been misled to think they were always foreign, but really the whole time the real enemies have been domestic.
Yeah. There's a new film apparently out too. I think it's called, I may be wrong about this, but I think it's called Virtual JFK. It's a documentary, and it examines specifically, it's by a young guy. I think he's an American, but he has a Japanese last name. But it's about whether or not JFK would have withdrawn from Vietnam, or would have, you know, taken the war in the same direction as LBJ. And this guy apparently has come across all sorts of information through the Freedom of Information Act, and also like some archival footage and stuff that's generally not discussed about Kennedy. And he concludes that conclusively that Kennedy would not have pursued the war at all the way that Johnson, that he really did intend to withdraw by late 1965 and withdraw all advisors. And I think I said in an earlier program when we were talking about this, one of the things that really strikes me now is that just revisiting the Kennedy assassination, and I think it's germane to the whole situation today. Like,
yes,
I think one of the reasons why Kennedy was assassinated, and I think that it was a coup d'état, was that certain people in the military and in the CIA were so disgusted with his policies and with what they regarded as his betrayal at the Bay of Pigs, and with reluctance to start a full-scale war in Vietnam, was that he was assassinated to remove him. And he even said, as I mentioned, you know, there's that book, 7 Days in May, which was made into a film by John Frankenheimer, starring Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas. And Kennedy actually contacted Frankenheimer and said, any help you want in making the film, I'm here to provide it, because he felt that there was a definite possibility that he was going to be overthrown by the military.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's funny, like, you know, you never hear that when you hear stuff about the Kennedy assassination. You know, everybody wants to talk about magic bullets and stuff, which is important, but you never talk about the real stuff. I see that now kind of in the sense that, you know, when you talk about the paranormal, is that, you know, rather than trying to discuss whether or not these things are real, you want to go beyond that question, because in a way it's kind of a phony question, and you want to see how would it be possible for this to be real. Well, that's the way I kind of look at the Kennedy assassination. I mean, I'm not even interested in discussing whether or not Lee Harvey Oswald shot John Kennedy. I know we did. I want to know why it happened, you know. It's like it's all misdirection, you know, and it's the same with 9/11. I don't really know what happened that day, but I know that what it was said happened. I'm pretty convinced it didn't happen at all, and again, I want to know why, but in terms of 9/11, it's pretty obvious is that these guys in the Project for a New American Century needed an event like Pearl Harbor.
It all makes sense.
Well, it not only does it make sense, they say it.
I know.
It's not like they're hiding it, you know? I mean, it would be one thing if somebody said, oh, then you'd be labeled as a conspiracy theorist, but they said it, you know?
Yeah.
It's in black and white. They tell you that, you know, and Brzezinski, Brzezinski, who was Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, comes right out and says in his book, whoever dominates Central Asia dominates the world. Well, guess what the American military is trying to do in Afghanistan and Iraq? They're creating a series of military bases to protect the pipeline to, transport gas from Central Asia, but also to dominate Central Asia. That was the whole battle between the Russians and the British in the 19th century. It was called the Great Game, you know, it was the battle to control Central Asia that led to the Crimean War, you know, and now it's being played out again, you know, 150 years later. But it's the same thing as if you dominate Central Asia, you control the world.
Yeah, and we see the patterns of deception through history too. The same old, like it's even learning about George Bush's family made their family fortune off financing the Nazis. And the Rockefellers made money, and J.P. Morgan, all these people, these huge wealthy people, were partly involved in financing the other side of that war.
Well, it's even worse, actually. The DuPonts, who were Jewish, did business with the Nazis.
The DuPonts, oh.
Yeah.
I never heard that.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's,
Oh, and Henry Ford was, a famous anti-Semite, and...
Oh, he was? I didn't know that.
Oh, yes. Yeah, a very, very racist, famous anti-Semite who, big fan of Hitler's, thought he had some really good ideas.
Yeah. Well, it's such a shame, but I see now how really I think in the world there could have been so much abundance for everybody. Everybody could have had basic living, health care, homes, food and be provided for. There was always enough wealth, but they created this poverty consciousness and depleted so much of the wealth of our nations all for the masters of war.
Yeah, and they didn't deplete it; they stole it. That's the amazing thing is that in the last 40 years, if you look at the concentration of wealth in most of the developed world, it's in a smaller and smaller percentage of the population's hands. You know, it's like, I mean, and this isn't any radical idea. This isn't anything. There's no doubt that this has happened. I mean, the figures are startling. Like how much of the wealth is concentrated in the top 2 or 3% of the population. You know, and that's why the middle class has shrunk so dramatically. And now with globalization, they don't even have jobs anymore because everything's outsourced and if it's cheaper to make a product in Mexico or in Africa or in China, that it will be made there. It won't be, these people aren't interested in
No, they don't want American workers to be paid a good living wage. I understand Ford is opening new plants in Mexico, 70,000 jobs, and they're going to import the parts from China into Mexico and assemble it in Mexico so they can use Mexican slave labor or pay them, a third of what they would have to pay the American counterparts.
Yeah, well, anywhere where there is, one of the things about globalization, it's anti-union, anywhere where workers are organized, that's where jobs will not go, it's a fact of life because, they don't want to pay things like health care benefits and they don't want workers who are organized who can make a decent wage, It's just that simple.
Yeah, and it's amazing, I can't grasp it all. I can't grasp how come all these different unions and groups and everyone aren't putting it together and seeing it. Why aren't there massive protests? And why aren't some of the military or the police or the CIA or the FBI? I mean... It's not that these people are all corrupted. Like most people in the CIA and FBI and the forces, I mean, I think they're well honorable men and women. I don't believe they're all corrupted like this.
No, I know they're not. I mean, but it, you know, it's hard to be a whistleblower, and you see what happens to people when they try to speak up. Too often, they're suppressed. I mean, look what happened to Sybil Edmonds, the FBI translator. You know, I mean, she's under court order not to speak about things. You know,
The New York firemen and police had a gag order imposed on those.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, people are afraid. I mean, as I say, in that respect, it's very much like the McCarthy era in terms of the political climate is so polarized that, you know, if you speak up, you're
really... Yeah, there's
really,
that culture of fear.
Yeah, and I mean, to a certain extent, too, like, I think, you know, people don't put it together to a certain extent. I mean,
no, they don't.
But in other ways, I think people see, like, we see aspects of it, and like there's a big scandal in New York over, you know, Giuliani is not very popular with the fire department because he was involved in showing favoritism to I don't know the details of this, I can't remember, it's kind of vague, but they had these radios that didn't work on 9/11, and the fire department knew that they didn't work, but Giuliani had imposed this contract on them, and you know, there was all sorts of complaints, and they'd been tested, and it was clear that these radios didn't work, and that was a huge problem that day. I mean, there's a firefighter from New York out there listening, and you want to phone in and talk about this, and that would be great, you know, but he's not very popular with you know, the great hero of New York is not very popular in the fire department because of you know, a lot of people blame him for what happened in terms of the radios failing that day. Like, a lot of people lost their lives because they couldn't communicate because they had bad radios.
Yeah.
You know?
But yeah, there's just so much. Did you see that? It's a funny picture of him dressed up as a woman. He's a transvestite, eh? And there was a picture of him dressed up as a woman with Donald Trump. Did you see that?
I didn't see that.
Oh, it shocked him. He looked quite attractive. You didn't know he was a Giuliani. But he was dressed up as a transvestite. I couldn't believe it.
For what purpose?
I don't really know. I don't know. Sorry?
He was trying to court the transvestite voter.
No, it was after he kind of dropped out of the race.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm being facetious, but I mean,
it was in the last 2 months, I'll try to send it to you sometime.
Yeah,
later.
Okay.
Another question. You mentioned the Kennedy. We were talking about that, and I heard something the other day. I'd want to hear if you'd ever heard this. I'd never heard this before, but apparently there's supposed to be a photo of George Bush Sr. standing beside the Book Depository building.
I've heard that, actually.
You've heard that, too.
Yeah, if you look at George Bush Sr., you know, eventually he was the head of the CIA, but at that time, I've read that he was in some way connected with the CIA at that point, and given that he was in the oil business, I mean, and that he was from Texas, you know, there's not a real, that's not a huge stretch, sort of, that he was active in Texas politics. Yeah, I've heard that, too. I don't know, you know.
Yeah, no, I don't know.
The other thing that's even more interesting is that Nixon was there.
Nixon was there
that day or the day before, but Yeah, he was in Dallas, and I mean, when you really start, that's one of the interesting things about the Kennedy assassination. If you really start reading about it, about the whole climate that existed in that place in Dallas and in the South in 1963, I mean, there were more lunatics running around there with guns than there were average people. It seems to me like, I mean, there were a lot of strange human beings let loose in that territory, and you know, I mean, I would say real fascists too. I mean, real Nazis. I mean, most of them. I mean, I read something, and again, I don't know about this, but that half the Dallas Police Department were members of the Ku Klux Klan. You know, and. The guy who was the chief of police was the brother of a general who had been fired by Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs.
Dulles?
Sorry?
Dulles?
Oh, no, not Dulles. Dulles was the CIA guy who was hired, who was fired, and then his brother... he was fired, and then he ended up on the Warren Commission investigating the assassination. He fired after the Bay of Pigs, Alan Dulles, and then he ended up investigating the Kennedy assassination, which involved members of the CIA and the military.
Wow.
You know, I wonder why they couldn't get to the real conclusion. I mean, it's just, like, so phony, you know. When you do read, I mean, there are all these anti-Cuban, Castro exiled Cubans and all these paramilitary groups who were training to invade Cuba, and there were all these people running around. And it was like in not only in Dallas, but like in especially in New Orleans and in South Florida, and there were all these different groups. And now it's come out too that there was an assassination attempt. Well, there was supposed to be an assassination attempt on Kennedy in Miami, and there was also supposed to be one in Chicago, right? And this has sort of come out after the fact, too, yeah?
Uh-huh.
And then there was this guy who's actually on tape telling an FBI informant that Kennedy's, you know, it's all in the works that he's going to be assassinated. This guy was a right-wing, millionaire, and he said, "Oh, it's in the works. He's going to be killed, you know." And he said he's going to be shot from a building in a city. And even that too, like the whole people who want to talk about Lee Harvey Oswald, it's like, you know, and want to focus on him. It's like, well, you have to focus on the other side of everything that happened in Dallas. It's like, how in God's name did the president ride in an open car through the streets of Dallas with open windows, where anybody could put a rifle out? I mean, you know, the standard protocol for the Secret Service to seal the windows, seal manhole covers, you know, the whole bit. How did they ever get the route to change to the point where he was driving like 10 miles an hour, you know, and then 12 miles an hour? I mean, it's basically a sitting duck, and he was shot in a crossfire, as the argument goes. If you're going to shoot him, one person, why wasn't he shot as he came up the first street, and then he turned like a more than a 90-degree turn. He was shot as he was actually driving away.
Oswald was behind him.
Yeah, shooting down. But if he was going to shoot him, he should have shot him when he was coming right at him. Like he was coming right up the street, going 10 miles an hour. He was, you know, but he was shot in a crossfire. That's the whole thing. And you know, the grassy knoll, like there's like 58 people who heard bullets, who said gunfire came from behind the fence on the grassy knoll, who smelled the gun smoke, who ran up the hill, and then a guy appeared bearing Secret Service credentials, and there were no accredited Secret Service agents in the area, you know? I mean, it's just like, I mean, as I say, anybody who wants to tell me that, and then you get these people in documentaries, Norman Mailer saying, you know, that who used to believe there was a conspiracy, no, Oswald did it, you know, and he was a punk, and I'm thinking, Norman.
Mailer said that?
Yeah, Norman was out of his mind at the end, you know, like, I mean, please. There's a documentary recently on, I think it was on PBS in the States, and Todd Gitlin, who was he's a professor of sociology at Berkeley and a critic of the media, and was former president of SDS and an anti-war activist, comes out with this statement. He says, Americans are paranoid in their thinking, and if you really want to go back to the idea of conspiracies and small groups, it's in the book of Revelations. And he says, so, you know, 666 is the mark of the beast, and that could be the CIA if you want it. And then he goes on, and I mean, he's talking about this in terms of the Kennedy assassination. Then he says, you know, this idea that a small cavil of people sitting around in rooms and make decisions, and I'm thinking, is you know, paranoid. And I'm thinking, like, Todd, you know, how the hell do you think the Vietnam War was decided, was fought? Small groups of people sat around in rooms and made decisions, you know? I mean, the Gulf War, the first one, was planned by about six people who sat around in a room and decided we're going to war, you know? I mean, what an incredibly moronic statement from a guy who's supposed to be intelligent, and who's supposed to be, you know, he's supposed to be left-wing. I was like, please, you know? He was, like you say, he was a very prominent anti-war activist, and I'm watching this, and I'm thinking, this is like Orwell. This is just, you know, this is so ludicrous.
Yeah.
Like, what the hell has the Book of Revelations got to do with the assassination of John F. Kennedy? Like, I mean, maybe it has something to do with it, but he was trying to suggest that, you know, oh, you can draw any kind of connection if you want. Well, yeah, I guess, but, you know, if you want to draw a connection that Lee Harvey Oswald killed John Kennedy, I guess you could draw that, too, but you'd be wrong, but, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's pretty fascinating watching this documentary because, as I say, and then Mailer, who had been supported Mark Lane when Mark Lane came out originally in Question. He was the first major critic of the Warren Commission. Mailer had been one of his supporters and said, you know, I think there's so, oh yeah, man, Mailer had been very active. And then Mailer wrote a book about Oswald, and then he comes out with this, as I say it in this documentary, it was near the end of his life, and he says, well, you know, originally he was going to make this great act, he was going to assassinate the president, but then he shot J.D. Tippit, who is a Dallas police officer who Oswald was supposed to have killed that day, and who is actually, he was charged with his murder. And, I mean, it's very equivocal as to whether or not Oswald shot him. It doesn't seem like he did, but even if he did, and then so Mailer said, but then he shot Tippit, so that made him a punk and no longer a great man, and so he couldn't hold himself up as a great man, and that's why he denied shooting Kennedy. And I'm thinking, Norman, you know, Norman, I like a lot of your books, and you're a smart guy, but that is the biggest pile of BS I've ever heard in my life, you know.
Well, it's funny,
it's so convoluted, you know, like, jeez.
I think often the elites have had these people who were seemingly on the side of truth and exposing things, but who really were also tied into the elites. Like, I wonder about Chomsky.
Well,
Chomsky won't even discuss 9/11.
Chomsky won't discuss 9/11, and Chomsky won't discuss, doesn't think there's anything in the, he says there's nothing there in the Kennedy assassination. And I have a lot of respect for Noam Chomsky on a variety of levels, but as I say, how anybody who says that to me is to my mind about the Kennedy assassination. I keep coming back to this because I think this was one of the first really dramatic evidences to me of how you can get away with anything. And that certain, and as they say, you know, 40 years later, I sort of came to the conclusion that it wasn't just a random act of violence, and it wasn't just a small group of people. I think, you know, for all the grief he's taken, I think Oliver Stone is the closest to the truth about it. I think it was a coup d'etat. And when you look at it and you listen to people talk about it, it's like a Rorschach test to me. And it's like, well, as soon as somebody tells me, oh, well, it's just this, it's like, it's so formatory with a lot of people, eh? Like, I mean, in Gurdjieff's sense, is that they haven't really thought about it. They haven't really examined it. They haven't really looked at the evidence. They just know that Lee Harvey Oswald did it. But then other people, as you say, I mean, now, when I hear Gitlin talk like that, you know, he's a suspect on my list now. It's like, because I thought that was about the most bizarre thing I've ever heard in my life when he was saying this in this documentary. I'm thinking, of all the things you could have said about the Kennedy assassination, why would you say that? And as they say, why would Chomsky said, well, I've looked at it and there's nothing there? Seymour Hersh, you know, the investigative reporter who broke the My Lai massacre and who said, you know, the foremost investigative reporter in the United States. You know, I've looked at the Kennedy assassination. There's nothing there.
Well,
wow. No, there. You know, come on, Seymour.
Yeah.
You know, you're too smart. You've got too big a BS detector to actually believe that. You know, like, so what's going on? That would be my question to him if I ever met him. I was like, come on, Seymour. Don't give me that. You know, like, come on. You know.
Do you know what Chomsky says about 9/11, or he just refuses to talk about it, or does he?
My impression is that I think that was in Barry Zwicker's book when he's talking about. I think he's the one that talked about Chomsky and how Chomsky, and he talks about the left. Zwicker, he's a Canadian journalist who has a book called Towers of Deception, and he did a documentary on Vision TV in Canada. That's a very good book, Towers of Deception.
About 9/11?
About the media coverage of 9/11 specifically.
Oh.
And he talks about the left response, like The Nation magazine, too. You know, they don't give it any consideration. You know, Nation is a left-wing magazine in the United States and very critical of the war and Bush and everything, but they don't look at 9/11. And he talks about Chomsky, and he says, you know, there's something very strange going on there that, my impression is that Chomsky just thinks that there's nothing to it, you know. That, and again, I just don't understand how anybody can look at the evidence and not be disturbed by it. It disturbs
me.
That people aren't disturbed. You know, it's like I'm very suspicious of anybody who's not disturbed by it, who's actually looked beyond. As I say, originally I just thought there was that French book came out right away after 9/11, said, "Oh, the CIA did it." And, you know,
oh, it did. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was a prominent book in France right after, and I thought, oh yeah, you know, the usual. You know, the CIA did everything. You know, but then you start looking at it and you realize, well, Osama bin Laden was a CIA agent when the war in Afghanistan before against the Soviets. You know, he was involved with the CIA and was supported by them and as part of the Mujahideen's battle with the Russians, with the Soviets.
Yeah.
But and as clearly, like, there are games within games in the intelligence quote unquote community, but you really wonder, like, boy, you know, like, you really wonder, like, how is it possible for anybody to look at 9/11 with an open mind and not be disturbed? And as I say, I'll go back to, like, the very basic question. It's like, you got this, to all Americans, you got this armed forces, which is the greatest armed forces in the history of the world, you know, and on the day when a couple of guys are supposedly flying these jets into buildings, you know, where the hell was your Air Force? You know, I mean, it's an important question. Where the hell was the American Air Force that day? Where were all these planes that you have? And
the more you see it, there is absolutely nothing that stands the test of truth about the official explanation. Everything falls apart when you go into it.
That's what's so disturbing about it, is that none of it really, you know, none of it really passes the smell test, because it all stinks. You know, like, I mean, aspect of it stinks. And again, as I say, you know, well, even the question of, like, you know, they took all this, they removed all this steel from the towers. And
that was Giuliani.
Yeah, they shipped it out of the country. It's a crime scene.
You know,
like, anybody who's ever watched the detective story knows you're not allowed to take stuff out of a crime scene, but they did it, you know, like, I mean, no, and nobody sort of said, hey, you know, wait a minute. You know,
people did protest to Giuliani, and he kind of said afterwards, oh, I didn't think that you might want us to keep it. Like, Giuliani is the one who was responsible for that, having it shipped out to China.
Yeah, boy.
And they guarded the site. They didn't want anyone to... But then you hear about someone like, who's a fellow, Jones, who got a sample of the steel.
Oh, it's Stephen Jones?
Stephen Jones. He got a sample of the steel from the trade towers, from one of the sculpture somewhere. He was given a sample.
Oh, yeah.
He tested it and determined there was thermite in it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure that's the whole story, but...
Yeah, supposedly there was...
Part of it, you know?
There was molten steel at the base too, and you know, days afterwards,
months afterwards, it was still burning.
And they say, like, you know, how is this possible that this kind of heat could? It couldn't have been generated from the jet fuel and the plane, you know, exploding and everything. Well, that's the other thing too, is that I gave this book to a friend of mine about 9/11. It wasn't specifically just about 9/11, but parts of it were. And he said the thing that really got him was that there was an American military guy who had been a pilot, and he was talking about the path of the jets that they flew that day. And he says, you want to tell me that a guy who had been trained on puddle jumpers, and, you know, like, you know, little planes, flew this jet and exercised this precise, you know, incredible turn? And that was the thing too about the plane that was supposed to have hit the Pentagon. It was that it was described as having done this complicated, well, Bush himself said, boy, that's great flying, you know, like, by this pilot. And this guy said, but this American military guy said, you want to tell me that somebody supposedly trained on puddle jumpers flew a big plane like that into this building and executed the turn? He said, preposterous, absolutely preposterous. He said, you know, there's absolutely no way that could be true. Like,
into the Pentagon, that plane.
No, this is
or the other one.
They hit one of the twin towers. He said it's impossible for somebody who, unless they'd been flying jets for a long time, could have exercised these turns. He said, you know, it's just too precise. It was flown by somebody who knew what they were doing, or was flown by remote control, which is a possibility.
I really don't know. It's funny because for me now, I even question. You know, we've seen all the shots of the second airplane hitting the South Tower, the second airplane. And there was that series I mentioned before on YouTube called September Clues that analyzes all the media from the day.
Oh, yeah.
And they have this one shot that was produced by Fox News Helicopter initially. And it showed the plane coming into the building. And then all of a sudden, its nose protruded out of the other side of the building. and they did a pixel analysis of the plane entering the building and the nose coming out, and it was exactly corresponded. And the point would be that the plane couldn't possibly go through the building and have its nose intact on the other side. But then they said within 7 to 8 minutes, Fox had edited that out, this nose out shot. It's called the nose out shot. Because really what I think, it was just concocted in the media studio.
But, you know, there were thousands of people who saw it.
Well,
I'm sorry, I find that very hard to believe, and almost, so my point would be kind of so, you know, like, I mean, somebody flew one plane into the building, I mean, but I find that really hard to swallow.
Yeah, I don't know. I have doubts.
Listen to anything, actually, you know, it's entirely possible, you know,
yeah.
Something screwy happened, but, you know.
I mean, I think it could have been, a missile or some other kind of, like, not a, you know, passenger airliner.
Yeah.
That's
what I'm
saying.
Like
I think something hit it.
Yeah. Oh,
or,
yeah.
See, they could have just had explosives in the buildings.
Oh, they did have explosives in the buildings.
No, but even where we thought the airplanes hit.
Yeah, but
they could have just blown out those areas and then superimposed the pictures of the airplanes flying.
But as I say, like, there were thousands of people in the street. That's why I find that hard to believe. I don't think they all hallucinated that a second plane flew into a building. In fact, you know, I mean, I've never heard anybody question that the idea that a second plane hit the building, because, like I say, there were all sorts of people there in the streets. I mean,
in this series, September Clues, they analyze a lot of the eyewitnesses' accounts, and all the eyewitness accounts were from people all who were TV producers and worked for the major news network.
Yeah, but come on, there was thousands of people in the streets. There's all sorts of people who worked there. Like, don't tell me that there weren't people who saw this that seems outrageous to me. Like,
well,
I'm sorry, that just seems so over the top. But again, almost like, kind of like, what's the point, you know?
Yeah, in a way, yeah, it's like the proof of the paranormal. Who cares, in a way?
It's like, but to me, that's like one of those pseudo issues. It's like, you know, it kind of takes you away from the more, you know, the more essential question is, what exactly happened, you know? Were there explosions in the building? And as I say, if you go on the basis of what, that really shocked me, is how many firefighters and police officers, and again, this goes back to your question earlier, it's like, you know, I think these people are essentially honest and honorable people, you know, these firefighters and these police officers who said that they heard explosions, you know, like, how is that buried? How is that not given some sort of credibility that, you know, shouldn't somebody be concerned about that?
All these eyewitness accounts. Yeah,
yeah.
It was even on the initial news from some of the major TV networks.
Yeah, exactly.
Because most of the reporters didn't know that there was a hoax being brought down.
Yeah.
You know, they were saying, they're claiming there seems to have been, you know, other secondary explosions in the building. It's all on the news, you know.
Yeah.
It's all the reporters
before it all gets edited out,
you know.
Yeah, you're right, exactly, yeah. It's like I say, it's like the grassy knoll in Dallas, you know, which has sort of become almost synonymous. Like, that phrase has become kind of synonymous with, disputable accounts of something, or you know, equivocal accounts of something that everybody saw. Like, I mean, with the grassy knoll, as I say, 58 people who were eyewitnesses on the ground there said that shots came from the grassy knoll. 58 people, but the Warren Commission said no, there were no shots in there.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden, if you were one of the 58 people or one of the millions of people who believed that the 58 probably knew what they were talking about, like the guy who had been in the military and who felt a bullet go by his ear, you know.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, a soldier. He said the bullet went right by his ear.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, but you know, in the aftermath of this, the grassy knoll is almost kind of like a joke, you know, like, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist if you believe that. Well, I mean, my reply to that would be, oh, are you one of those idiots who believes that Lee Harvey Oswald actually shot John Kennedy? I mean, you know, that's not very sophisticated.
Yeah, I usually ask people if they believe in Santa Claus.
Yeah, exactly.
If they believe it, I equate Osama bin Laden. It's like believing in Santa Claus, you know, because you've seen Santa Claus on TV.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You've seen him. I saw him on TV, you know.
Exactly.
He must exist, you know.
Howdy doody.
Yeah.
Howdy doody. He used to be on TV every day, so he must exist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I heard someone on Coast to Coast the other night. It was so funny. He kind of dismissed the conspiracy theories because he said, well, but I saw it on TV.
Yeah. That's like when you were in New Zealand, too. I was flipping around the dial one night, and Larry King had these guys on, three American military guys who were stationed in Great Britain in the 1950s. And they had gone out to investigate a UFO report and had seen this craft on the ground. And I think one of them had actually been quite close to it, and it took off and off the ground and you know, flew away. And I think one of them had been burned by it or something. Anyway, so they had this skeptic guy, you know, come phones in, and he's on with Larry, like he's linked up with Larry, and he's explaining to these guys that they didn't see what they saw, you know, and he's going through, he'd investigated this, and there was nothing to it. And these guys are sort of sitting there with these looks on their faces, like, you know, he's saying, what you saw was car lights reflected off the atmosphere, you know, and the guy said, well, I've never seen car lights actually take off in front of me and ascend into the sky, you know, and it was like the looks on these guys' faces when this guy was explaining to them how they were, you know, how they were wrong about what they'd seen with their own eyes and what, you know, it was right in front of them, eh? It was like so hilarious listening to this guy, and it was so interesting when you listen often to people who are skeptical about things, is that, you know, as the skeptics always point out how delusional people can so, you know, strongly believe these things, and they're quite sincere. But I mean, I see it with skeptics. I see how they're so sure of themselves. You know, like I say, they were there, and this guy was so sure that they hadn't seen what they'd seen. You know, it's quite amazing, actually.
Yeah. No, I think a lot of these people, I think it's the PsyCops people, the Committee for the Investigation of the Claims of the Paranormal, I imagine a number of these groups are sponsored by the Rockefellers. Like, that's my suspicion of these groups. Because it's not even like they're serious scientists. I mean, they're just professional naysayers. I think they're complete frauds.
I don't know about that, because, I mean, PsyCop was formed by, you know, pretty reputable people like Carl Sagan and Martin Gardner and Arthur C. Clarke. I mean, it was like some pretty big, you know, reputable names. I mean, and I don't even disagree with, you know, with their right or with their perspective on a lot of things. I think they're right about a lot of things and with what they say in terms of producing evidence. I just question whether or not they're as open-minded as they claim to be, and I just see that you know, when it comes to a lot of things involving the paranormal. But I mean, I don't see how one way or another, like the Rockefellers, could give a rat's ass about that. Like, I mean, in some.
Oh,
ways,
it's funny now. I think the way I see it, I think the Rockefellers have been very major influence in the educational system of North America.
Well, almost everything.
As intentionally, you know, distorting historical data, like to obscure what really happened in World War II, and in economics to prevent people from learning about the Fed. And I think in psychology, the dismissal of the science of the soul, I think they've had a major influence on the educational system, intentionally dumbing down Americans and Canadians.
I completely disagree with that. I don't know how you can say that, because I don't know what the conspiracy would be involved. I mean, I'll point one thing out to you, is that you're right about major corporations doing research. You know, at one time, I don't know if this is still true, but at one point, in the 1970s, do you know who financed more, who was the biggest financier of children's psychological research? Guess who was the biggest financier? McDonald's.
Yeah, oh yeah.
They contributed more money to, in the United States, to psychology departments financing children's psychology, because they want to know how to make them customers for life, you know?
Yeah. I think things like that are quite legitimate in ways.
Well,
like,
but that's always been there. I mean, it goes back to Vance Packard in the 50s and the hidden persuaders, you know? It's like the corporations have always manipulated people and have always actually been out ahead of, like Lloyd Strickland, a social psychologist that was my thesis advisor, always used to say, when you get right down to it, the best social psychologists, if you apply the standard of prediction and control, are market researchers. He said they're 100 times better than academic social psychologists. Academics don't know anything compared to these guys. So these guys are friggin' geniuses. You know, like, I mean, things like orange and yellow are bright orange and yellow are, you know, that's why Burger King and McDonald's have these colors, are attractive to children in terms of food. You know, they're linked with attention to food, you know. So I mean, these guys are pretty sharp about this stuff. And I mean, as I say, Vance Packard wrote, called The Hidden Persuaders.
Yeah, I remember that.
In the 50s, you know, and it's like, well, even going back to that whole thing about, you know, how they used to use subliminal perception in advertising. You know, there was a famous cigarette ad where the word cancer was actually in the ad, you know, like, I mean, which is kind of like, I don't know how that works, but apparently it works in terms of, maybe it's like, you know, you can smoke and overcome your fear of getting cancer. I don't know, you know.
But these guys certainly
do their research, you know, like, you know.
You mentioned Lloyd Strickland, and I've been thinking about some of his research just recently, because he had a very famous study where he had people working where they were under surveillance and not under surveillance.
Oh, okay.
And the point of his research was that the more people that, like, if you had a witness seeing some people working under conditions of surveillance and others working with no surveillance, that the observer judged the people who were working under surveillance as being less trustworthy.
Oh, interesting, yeah.
It's very interesting because it's like how they're creating this culture of fear of terrorism, and the more and more they put the cameras out there. So, I mean, in England, downtown London, England, don't they have 300,000 cameras?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, like,
yeah,
holy,
you know why?
Fuck, someone's whacked. You know?
But you know why?
Well, do I know why?
Do you know why they have those cameras?
No.
Well, because during the, all through the 60s and the 70s, the IRA kept blowing people up, and people are very happy to have those cameras there. You can't leave anything in downtown London. I mean anything. Any kind of a package, you'll be investigated. It will be investigated. And if they see you leaving it, you'll be investigated, because they blow people up, and they blew them up for like 30 years, and people sort of took it personally, you know? Like, I mean, it's the same.
Yeah, okay, well, that's good. That's interesting to know that background.
It's the same in Israel,
about
because that's why, you know, like, I mean, it changes. Like, it's one thing for people who don't have this experience and haven't lived with it, but, like, I used to go through Victoria Station when I was visiting London every day, and about a week after I came home to Canada, the kiosk where I stopped to buy the newspaper every day, somebody blew a bomb up and killed somebody, you know? Cause
wow.
And, I mean, this is a thing, like, you know, it's easy to sit back, like, if you're in North America and you're safe. And, I mean, this is the whole thing about 9/11, too, is that suddenly Americans found out, like, how the rest of the world lives, in the sense that, you know, most of the places in the world is pretty dangerous. Like, if you live in Israel, you know, and you can't send your kids out to go to a movie or something without fearing that they're going to be blown up by terrorists, it changes your attitude.
Oh,
you know?
It's terrible.
Like, your next-door neighbor, for sure. Your next-door neighbor goes to the market to buy some fruit, you know, and you know, their head is blown 500 yards, you know, out of the market. I mean, this traumatizes people and changes their hardens their attitudes towards surveillance. Like I say, in London, that's why the cameras are there, and that's why people don't object to it, you know. Like, I mean, I was walking through the London airport with a bag, you know, and guys came up, and, you know, in England, the police don't carry guns, eh?
But oh, they still don't?
No, but in the airport, these guys, they were carrying guns, and they asked me to open my bag, and then, you know, oh, sure, you know, like, they check everybody. I mean, it's kind of, but that's a really interesting thing that you're bringing up.
About Strickland's research. How it makes you, the more and more you're surveyed, it's more, the more you come to mistrust other people.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, the other experiment I thought, I was thinking of early social psychological research and how I think it's been used by the elites, and the other was the Milgram experiments.
Oh, yeah.
You must be familiar with those. Yeah, and those are classic experiments, and those were done, I forget, it was a major American university. The point of the experiment was they brought subjects in, and the subjects were told that it was a learning situation, and they sat down at a panel where they could deliver all these shocks to another person in another room. And they were supposed to shock them every time the person made a mistake in learning. And they had like 40 buttons on this big panel, and, you know, began at 5 volts and worked up to hundreds or thousands of volts, okay? And they wanted to see how far people would go to continue to administer shocks, even while the person in the other room after a while began to protest and they wanted out and they didn't want. And then at one point the person who was supposed to be learning in another room, they even stopped answering. And it was like 70% of the people continued to shock these people if they were told by the experimenter that the experimenter took responsibility for it and it was part of the experiment and so on and so forth. And what they found was all these people would administer all these huge shocks to people.
Yeah, there were people screaming, actually, in the other room, like the victims of the...
Yeah.
And it started out like, ow, and then like, ah, you know, like, and it got worse and worse.
Dead, and they were pleading, and
please,
the people
please.
Kept going, and this was normal Americans, kind of.
Yeah. Well, I think part of the impetus of that was, like, for Milgram, if I remember correctly, I mean, it certainly was the whole idea about, you know, the Nuremberg trials and the average German is like, how could you go along with this? Well,
yeah, wondering how people would do things
people,
like this.
Well,
yeah.
and that's my point is that, you know, about the current situation in the United States and in all of the Western world, but it's most pronounced in the United States because that's where 9/11 happened and where that's where the most power is. Is that really you create this climate of fear and then you manipulate people, you know?
Yeah.
And the disturbing thing is that people are quite happy to go along with it. And as they say in Canadian history, you know, we can't be very smug or, you know, like look down our noses at anybody. We rolled over like, you know, just on the flimsiest of pretext, you know, that the phrase was that there was an incipient insurrection in Quebec because a diplomat and a minister of the Quebec government had been kidnapped, two people. And, you know, Trudeau, who was a civil libertarian prime minister of Canada, imposed martial law. They invoked the War Measures Act, which was passed, I believe, during the First World War to suspend civil liberties. And then, you know, you remember living in, I think you were still in Ottawa at that point.
Yeah, I remember that.
The army was in the streets. I mean, there were guys running around with guns, you know, and it's like...
Yeah, and it was just one person got...
Well, two people got kidnapped, one guy got killed, you know, it's kind of funny because in the States, you know, this had come after the, you know, multiple years of rioting, you know, in the ghettos every summer and then in response to the assassination of Martin Luther King, you know, and the anti-war protests and the burning of the Bank of America in Santa Barbara, and it was like all sorts of wild things were happening in the States, you know, all the time. And, you know, there might be martial law imposed in the cities, but, I mean, there was never kind of that blanket suspension. I mean, what in God's name would you suspend the civil liberties of people living in Saskatchewan for, you know, when there's a protest in Quebec or like an upheaval in Quebec? I mean, it made absolutely zero sense, you know, but it was an excuse to crack down on the Quebec separatist movement. But it just shows how quickly people went along with it. And afterwards, even like Gerard Pelche, who was a minister in the Canadian government, a very close friend of Trudeau, said, you know, well, we completely overreacted, you know, and there was never really any evidence to suggest that, you know, that this was as bad as we made it out to be. I mean, he admitted it, but nobody really cared, you know. Well, okay.
Yeah. Well, it's like all these security measures now at airports and particularly at airports, like how now everybody's got to take their shoes off before you get on an airplane because there was this one kook who flew to the States and tried to light his shoes on fire. So everybody, millions of people, see, it's how they incrementally get people to accept martial law, suspension of their civil liberties, and in creating the fear, and then they offer the solution.
Yeah, it's incredible.
It's funny. I heard yesterday that since 9/11, Canadian authorities have spent $5 billion on security measures. And I think one thing about the elites is they own all the security companies.
Well, yeah.
That's a huge part of this because they want to sell their cameras. They want every store to have their camera in. You know, I can't even go to the grocery store now. Everywhere you go in the grocery store, there are cameras, you know?
Yeah.
There was no...
Smile.
You know, it's just so unbelievable. But everybody thinks, oh, you got to have it, you know, security, security.
Well, who do you think is the biggest beneficiary of the war on terror in the United States? I mean, it's just say happy people like Halliburton, you know, Cheney's former company, are now registered in, I think it's Dubai, so that they, you know, don't have to pay taxes in the United States.
Yeah, and he can escape there when they bring down America.
Yeah, well,
yeah, Bush gets to go to Paraguay where they don't have extradition treaties, and he's got some Nazi friends down there.
There's all sorts of, you know, these mega corporations that are the ones that are making the amount of fraud in Iraq is unbelievable. And
it's being
carried out by these guys who are just stealing money. And then, of course, the other thing too is this whole rise of the private armies, eh? Like there's so many.
Yeah, the Blackwater, terrible.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
that's in Canada too, eh?
Oh yeah, well everywhere. I mean, and this is the whole thing. Is that, you know, the rich, you know, first it was gated communities. Now they're going to have their own armies. You know, like, I mean, it's like,
For what? Have you heard of one legitimate terrorist being caught in the United States over the last five years?
Nobody's been caught. Nobody, you know,
never caught anyone in Canada.
Well, I know. Well, they
There's
caught
not one
guys.
Person.
Well,
oh,
these,
those group in Toronto.
They caught these
who
guys
they
in,
set up.
They caught these guys in Toronto who, as I say, are looking less and less guilty every day goes by. And like, you know, already like six or seven of them have the charges dismissed against them. Just like these young Muslim guys who, you know, wanted to play with paintballs, you know, up north. I mean, Jesus, you know, like what a joke. But that's the whole thing, is that, you know, under the Patriot Act, is like all these people are arrested and detained and everything, and it's led to zero convictions. Nobody's ever been convicted. You know, you got all these guys that, you got all these guys in Guantanamo, and you know, which is like the biggest affront to civil liberties ever. You know, and you just want to make them a special status. Well, they're not really prisoners of war, and they're not really common criminals. You know, we'll call them enemy combatants, and we won't have to produce any evidence to suggest why they're guilty of something. I mean, that's the other thing that's bizarre about it. It's like, wait a minute, you guys went halfway around the world to Afghanistan, and you're attacking people, and they fought back, and so you arrest them and say, well, you're not
really... As enemy combatants.
Yeah, as enemy combatants. I mean, does nobody see the absolute absurd logic in this? I mean...
Especially when 9/11 wasn't even done by them in the first place.
Well, yeah, exactly. But poor Afghanis, you know, like, geez. Well, they must think that they've done something really horrible, because that nation has basically gotten it from everybody, you know. It got it from the British.
Oh, it's terrible.
Got it from the Soviets. It's got it from, you know, the warlords and the Taliban. And, I mean, this is just the ordinary people who are trying to live their life, you know.
Yeah,
and now there's like
disgusting.
A couple of million in exile because they can't live in their own country, you know, because everybody wants to fight, you know.
Yeah. Well, at least the CIA's got the drug trade back now.
Well, yeah, that's good.
As long as
the heroin's flowing, everybody will be happy, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, the Taliban, you know, you wouldn't want to have anybody stop the drug trade because...
There's too much money in it.
Yeah, well, exactly, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, too much money in it. I mean, that's basically the answer for everything, too much money in it. As long as there's a lot of money in it, people will do anything, you know, and rationalize their own misconduct.
Yeah, it's funny how people will sell their souls. That's how I see it.
Well, that's exactly what it is. It's that people sell their souls, you know.
Yeah.
I keep coming back to what you talked about many times. It's like how... You know, I mean, it's really interesting in terms of, like, what we've talked about in terms of Gurdjieff says that, you know, there's the man number one, two, and three who are people who are sleepwalkers and who are different in terms of types. And so there's an intellectual type of man, which is man number three, and then there's an emotional man number two, and then there's a moving instinctual man number one who sort of more centered in their body, and like and that corresponds in terms of the yogic teachings in terms of the three lowest chakras. You know, people are dominated by sex, money, and power. Eh? Like,
yeah, the three lower chakras.
Yeah, and I see that, like how that. You know, you could look at us, I mean, it's funny, like, you could almost look at us in terms of sociobiology, you know, in terms of an evolutionary perspective of how much of the human race is just like these three forms of lower apes, you know, like, I mean, or higher apes, I don't know, maybe that's an insult to apes, but we're really quite low in terms of our consciousness and our level of being, and it, as Gurdjieff says, you know, it's like civilization consists of lies and fine words and lies, you know.
Wow.
And if you scratch the veneer, you see underneath that people are really just as savage as they were, you know, hundreds of years ago and thousands of years ago, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's essentially, I keep coming back to this, but when Henry Miller wrote this brilliant essay at the end of the Second World War called Murder the Murderer, and he says, you know, and he just questions everything about the war, you know, and it's like, it's real. It's a really radical analysis of things, but it's radical in the sense that Miller was apolitical. He was an anarchist, not a bomb-throwing anarchist, but a person who didn't believe in governments. And his premise in this whole analysis of the war is to say, what right does the state have to ask anyone to give their life? He said, you know, if I thought that somebody sincerely had come to that decision that they wanted to go out there and put their life on the line for their country, that'd be one thing. He said, I have no quarrel with that kind of person. That's their decision. Fine for them. But he says, we're brainwashed into this kind of thinking. And the state always promises that, well, the state always premises whatever they're doing is that they've been forced into this action by the actions of others, and that they're so depraved that we have to go to war with them, and we have to stop them from doing what they're doing, and we have to ask people to give their lives. And the promise is that if we win, you know, life will be better for everybody. But he says it's a complete, you know, it's a mug's game, because the promise is never fulfilled, because the state just wants to perpetuate itself and never really delivers the good, so to speak, in terms of a better life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He started that at the beginning. It was an argument he had with a friend of his who had volunteered to be a private in the French army during the Second World War. And then he finished it at the end of the war. And he says, you know, like you look at the end of the war, and he breaks it all down in terms of the victors and the vanquished, and he predicts, you know, he said, this is just the beginning. You know, you think the atomic bomb is the end of this? This is just the beginning. In no time at all, we'll be arming the heavens themselves, you know, which is exactly what happened, eh? And when you read this, you realize, like, how can this guy, and this is now, that essay would be almost 65 years old. How can this guy have, if you compare it to all these political pundits, how can he have been so on the money about things as the way things were going to happen, the way things were going to turn out, when he's so opposed to the conventional wisdom about everything? Well, it's because his analysis is based on psychology and you know, not in terms of politics. And you realize, like, this guy is penetrating to the heart of things, and that really, you have to understand things psychologically and see through all the surface noise, like all the cover stories that people put out there, all lies.
Yeah, all lies.
All lies,
so,
and fine
lies.
Words, and really disguise the reality of the situation is that, you know, people want you to die or to give your life for some sort of ideal, but they never deliver on it, you know? It's like you have the Civil War, you know, and then you have the Spanish-American War, and then you have the First World War, and then you have, you know, and then you have the Second World War, and then you have Korea, and then you have Vietnam. It's like, you know...
Yeah, and all these things are based on lies and fraud.
Yes, all lies.
And really, they're all created by the masters of war who build the jet planes, as Dylan sang.
Build the big guns. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, and the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, you know? And I
is
mean,
that Dylan or
Leonard? No, I've got to think
Cohen.
Of Leonard Cohen, yeah. That everybody
rich
knows, you know,
the
rich get
the
rich and the poor get poor.
Poor.
Yeah. Like,
everybody
yeah.
knows.
Everybody knows, yeah.
Jim, do you want to give out the numbers once again? And I'm going to just take a break here for 1 minute, and I'll be back.
Okay, I'm going to have to find it. So.
Okay, and yeah.
If I can find these numbers, BBS call-in phone numbers. In the U.S. it's 877-876-5227. In Canada it's 888 815-975-9756. And I believe the direct line is still working, 530-876-3222. So, again, in the U.S., 877-876-5227. In Canada, 888-815-9756. Yeah, so if anybody has any response to all these things that we've been talking about, it certainly would be interesting to hear from you. Agree or disagree, you know, you can phone and tell us that we're completely off the wall and we don't know what we're talking about. You're listening to BBS Radio. This is Zero Point with Dr. Christopher Holmes. My name's Jim Moffat, and Christopher Holmes is the host of this program. Has disappeared for a couple of minutes, so we're just taking a little break here. We've been talking about, generally we speak about esoteric teachings and their relation to modern science and psychology, and especially the study of the nature of consciousness, human consciousness. And in the last, I guess about the last year or so, we've talked more and more about the world situation, specifically with respect to 9/11 and with everything that's happened since 9/11. And we place more and more emphasis on that in our talks. I was just saying that, you know, the program is devoted to an examination of esoteric and mystical conceptualizations of consciousness and how they relate to modern science and psychology, but how we've, in the last year or so, we've placed more emphasis on the world situation and specifically in relation to post 9/11 and the big
lies. It's funny how that's happened. I find I can't let it go anymore. It's like I don't feel, it's funny, I feel in a way how I've lost my world. Like I used to believe that, you know, basically the governments were, like, responsible. I mean, there might be some criminal aspects, but not totally criminal. Like, I see the states now. I mean, they're a terrorist nation, and they're run by a group of mass-murdering psychopaths. You know, that's how I see it now. You
well,
know?
Don't pull any punches. Tell us how you really feel. Well, yeah.
You know,
exactly.
It's just incredible. It's beyond anything I could have imagined. It reminds me of the Gnostic Gospels of what they call the
nightmare parable. Yes.
Where everybody's killing each other, and then you kind of wake up and you realize it's all been a dream.
Yeah.
Well, it's like, you know, I always believed in the American dream and thought America was this great country, and then kind of wake up and like, holy smokes, you know, the CIA's exported terrorism around the world. They mass murdered people everywhere. It's incredible. They got weapons around the world. Just what's happening in the world is just inconceivable.
Yeah. Well, I'd accuse you of being an extremist in your perspective, but I basically agree with it. And I mean, I sort of have held that view for many years. And you know, at times you kind of slip into thinking, well, things aren't that bad. But you really, if you really look at the whole pattern of the last, it's like Gore Vidal says, like since 1948 and the National Security Act, the American government has become the national security state. You know, under Harry Truman, that led to the creation of the CIA. And I think that's actually very accurate. I wanted to come back to something, though, that you were talking about earlier, and when you're talking about social psychological research and Lloyd Strickland and then Dr. Stanley Milgram the famous experiment. You know, the other one that I always think of is
Zimbardo?
That was the prison guard one, eh?
Yeah, why don't you explain that a bit?
Well, just that Zimbardo, I don't know if you remember, we saw him speak in the Canadian Psychological Convention in Vancouver in 1976. Fantastic speaker. But Philip Zimbardo did a very interesting experiment where he had people role play prison guards and prisoners. And the gist of what happened was that within a very brief period of time, people who were in the dominant position where they were the prison guards were really excessive in their treatment of the prisoners and really disturbingly so. And it took very, very, you know, even though it was role-playing, it took very, very little time for them to fall into exercising excessive authority really overstepping any kind of rules that had been set down for their behavior, and essentially the what he was suggesting was that it's just so easy for people who are in a position of power to fall into to act excessively. And very disturbing study.
I think that has so much relevance to what I see as upcoming in the States, where they have, you know, these 600 or 800 huge concentration camps built by Halliburton, all armed, I mean, all prepared and empty at the moment. And I think, there's going to be all
where
of a sudden.
Where are these concentration camps?
Well, look on the internet. They're around the States. There's some in every state. I mean, there's hundreds of them.
Really?
Yeah. This is where the truth movement people are going to end up, in my view.
Well, I wouldn't say that it's impossible, but I kind of question that. But I mean, in terms of Abu Ghraib is a perfect example. You know, where you create this climate where you essentially give tacit, if not explicit, permission to people to abuse these people, and you. Create them as being subhuman, or create this image of being them being subhuman. I think that was part of the manipulation in the Zimbardo experiment, wasn't it? That there was some sort of differentiation as to how the prisoners were presented. So it was basically the group that was perceived as being worse that were the ones that were treated worse. But I have a feeling that was part of it. But the other thing I wanted to come back to about, you mentioned Lloyd. Strickland I completely forgot about that study that Lloyd had done, but he used to tell me that he was very interested in what had happened during the Korean War, because during the Korean War there had been many American prisoners who had been brainwashed by the Koreans when they were captured, and that's the basis for the story in the film The Manchurian Candidate. The original Manchurian Candidate story is where they had brainwashed these captured GIs and then sent them back to the States, and the guys were sort of programmed to, with certain words, hypnotized to respond to certain words, like, would you like to play some solitaire? And then that would set the guy off, and then he exercised and assassinated the senator, the person running for president. But Lloyd said that what really interested him was that he had been in the Navy, I believe, maybe during the Korean War period, because he had been that age. I don't think he was old enough to have served in the Second World War. I think he was in the Navy during the Korean War.
He was American, wasn't he?
American, yeah. He was an American, yeah. And he said that the Navy had debriefed all these guys about their brainwashing experiences. And he said, geez, And he said, these things exist. These tapes exist, eh? And I think they were actually in the public domain. I don't think they were classified or anything. He said, God, he always talked about that. He said, I'd like to get my hands on that and really, really try to analyze what exactly they did, because I don't know how sophisticated the techniques were,
brainwash them.
Well,
deprogram them.
The first part was trying to understand what exactly had happened to them, is what they recollected happened to them, and then trying to deprogram them. But I don't know how sophisticated the Koreans had been in terms of in cults where the standard technique is that you basically malnourish people, to make them more suggestible. That's a standard technique is that you reduce their caloric intake, and then they're more impressionable, and they're more disoriented, and it's easier to get them to fixate and perseverate on certain ideas, and implant certain ideas about them. But it would be very interesting. I always thought that was interesting, that he was interested in that, and it's kind of forgotten that this whole phenomenon of the brainwashing, and you just see that the. Like, I think in part that was the beginning in the 50s of this whole fascination with the idea of mass manipulation. And, I mean, that would be an interesting historical study to do, is just to study the evolution of academic psychological study of mass manipulation and brainwashing, Early psychology was dominated with hypnosis and what could or could not be done under hypnosis, but I mean, this is on a completely different scale, and then, of course, in the 60s and 70s, this led to kind of fascination with cults and how people could be manipulated in cults, but in a sense, I mean, the whole political culture is that, if you're watching the evening news every night, you're part of a cult, you're part of that cult of of mass deception, you know. Like,
yeah, the public has been brainwashed.
Yeah.
I mean, I see that totally, how brainwashed people have been by the media, intentionally.
Well, you see it in the repeated, it stuck me during the first Gulf War, that you had this repetition describing Saddam Hussein as this Mideastern madman, you know.
This
was over and over again, this madman, and George Bush, the elder, had compared him to Hitler. And I'm thinking, well, is this the same Saddam Hussein that, you know, that the Americans and the British and the French and all of the Western countries supported when he attacked Iran and when he used gas on them and the Americans provide him with satellite data to attack Iran? Like, is this the same guy who's a Mideastern madman? And I'm thinking, Mideastern madman, like, compared to who, you know, like Gaddafi or, you know, the Ariel Sharon, or what's his name, the guy in Syria. I mean, I mean, they're all kind of Mideastern madmen, aren't they? The Ayatollah Khomeini. I mean, it was like such a weird thing to keep repeating. But the more you kind of demonize, and I mean, this isn't in any way an apology for Saddam Hussein, but what I'm trying to say is that, yeah, he was a Mideastern madman, but, you know, he had a lot of company, you know. And what about the madman in the Pentagon and the White House, you know?
Like, yeah, I mean, a year or so before, he was meeting with Donald Rumsfeld
and
all these characters. And even when the Americans, when at one point after the last war, they discovered this big armory of weapons, and they were all made in the USA, their chemical and biological weapons.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's even like now, you know, I fear another kind of false flag terrorist event in the States. You know, maybe they'll use bird flu or something. But my suspicion is it won't be, you know, it'll be blamed on someone else or something like that. But it'll be done by the elites themselves.
Yeah, well,
they're the ones who've manufactured these biological weapons.
I certainly wouldn't dispute that. I mean, it's like, I mean, there's even doubt about the, you know, the whole phenomena that happened when, you know, Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait, you know, and what exactly was discussed with the U.S. ambassador April Glaspie, and whether it's alleged that she said, well, we don't really have any problem with that, you know, that go ahead, and and then it was denied later. But and then all of a sudden, you know, it's like they have this, you know, big coalition of people who are outraged, and you know, it's interesting to talking to people at that time. It's like, because I kept thinking, it reminded me, the whole thing that leading to both the Gulf War and to the current war in Iraq, it very much to me is just like, you know, how the Germans agitated during the Second World War about troubles in the Sudetenland and how the their borders with France and Czechoslovakia, and how they had, you know, historical rights to these areas, and they, you know, had these false flag operations. I mean, basically the same kind of thing, you know. And then you have the burning of the Reichstag, you know, and it's like they blame it on the communists, and you know, it's like, yeah, it's like, and I remember saying that to people, and they kind of looked at me like during the first Gulf War. I said, you know, I said, well, you know, it seems to me it's the same kind of thing. Like, I just, you know, people have very short memories of this, because I mean, I knew that Saddam Hussein had been supported by the West, you know, because at the time, in 1979, and he started that war, you know, Iran was the big boogeyman because they'd taken the American hostages, you know, and so they were the people who were supposed to be the worst players in the Middle East. But of course, you know, like a few years later, all of a sudden, it's like everybody's forgotten that. I'm thinking, doesn't anybody remember when this guy was supposed to be a good guy? You know? I mean,
yeah.
It's just really peculiar how, like, this lack of any kind of sense of history, you know, and any kind of, like, probing, like, beyond the conventional explanation of things. So I was quite shocked when I read this book about the history by James Aronson of the leading up to the Cold War and the press coverage, and he was talking about how I.F. Stone had written this book, which was actually published in England and couldn't be published in the States, where he kind of questioned the whole explanation that had been repeated in the United States about the start of the Korean War and how it was all Korean communist aggression. And he said, you know, people in Europe were quite aware that that was complete and utter BS, you know, like that's not what happened. And you never hear anybody ever question that, you know, oh, it was, you know, Korean War. I mean, I'd always thought that was started by by communist aggression, and it's just not true. Like,
yeah.
You know, I mean, everybody knows now that Vietnam and the Gulf of Tonkin was a complete, you know, was
another fraud. Yeah.
Well, it's like, if it keeps happening over, if it happens once, you know, it's a coincidence. If it happens twice, you know, it's a trend, and if it happens three times, it's a pattern, you know? It's like,
yeah.
And if it happens over and over again, you just realize that's how these guys work, you know? It's it's like in that movie, Wag the Dog, you know, which, you know, you've seen that, eh, with Dustin Hoffman, and, oh, you should see that. You definitely should see that movie.
Oh.
It's all about, well, a president like Bill Clinton gets in trouble, and, with personal issues and has to extract himself. So he brings in a media consultant and he says, you know, what you need is something to distract attention. So you need a conflict. And so when they're discussing where they're going to have this conflict, they're trying to decide. And I'm thinking, how about Albania? Nobody cares about Albania. And then they say, how about Albania? Nobody cares about Albania, you know. And they create this whole kind of phony thing, and they have a media event, you know, and they make a commercial basically for the war, just like they did with the Gulf War, you know, when the girl came and testified in the United States and said that the Iraqi soldiers had come into the Kuwait hospital and ripped babies out of the incubators. And
the whole thing was a fraud.
Well, it was all produced by Hills and Knowlton, which is a public relations firm in the United States, and she was a member of the Kuwaiti royal family, this girl who was supposed to be, you know, just somebody who had witnessed this, and it never happened, and, you know, it was repeated over and over again to justify going to war, you know what I'm thinking?
Yeah. Well, the media just lies and lies and lies, and the media and politicians, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
What, the Nuremberg, it's interesting because all the people in the media, like the way I see it now, like, U.S. and Canada both have laws which prohibit the funding of terrorist activities, and really, if you can, by American or Canadian law, the state can take all the money and resources of anyone who's involved in sponsoring terrorism.
Yeah.
So if you actually enforced American law, you could take all the wealth of all Halliburton, all these big, all the media, all of these things would simply be taken away from these people.
Yeah.
I mean, they've all been involved in conspiracies, mass murdering, and deceit of the public and everything. I mean,
well, that's partly why the United States has always resisted any membership in the International Court of Justice. They don't want anything to do with it because they know that they could be hauled up, you know, in front of for war crimes. Eh? And they always say, oh, well, you know, anti-Americanism would lead to frivolous charges against American military people. Well, that's not who they're really protecting. They're protecting themselves because they could be arrested, you know, if you can haul Milosevic out and try him. You know, why couldn't you take George Bush to The Hague and try him, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Cheney.
Absolutely. I mean, hopefully that's what'll happen, is that these people will have to face their war crimes.
Yeah, I think they're going to have to answer to a higher authority than...
I do, too.
Yeah.
I do, too.
That's the only thing that I find comforting in all this, is I really do believe at some level, you got to answer, you know, there's no free lunch, even in terms of that, like at some point, you know, as you said, you know, these people have sold their souls and they're going to pay for it. Ironically, you know, there's so many of them present themselves as being Christians, and they're the farthest thing from Christians that you could possibly imagine, you know, like,
And then now
there's
in
that
the
great
state,
line, you know, in Masters of War, that where Dylan says that even Jesus wouldn't forgive the things that you do, you know, like, that's the way I feel about it. I don't think Jesus would forgive these guys. Maybe.
No.
Maybe, but with an explanation, you know. Anyway, I guess we're getting running out of time here. Right?
Well, yeah, let me see. Well, we just have a minute or two. Okay, so... this is, I would encourage listeners, check out my zeropoint.ca website. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time again. And I'd like to thank BBS Radio.
Is that a cat or a baby?
That's my cat.
Okay.
He's called Black Cat. He's black.
Okay.
Okay, kitty, okay. He wants some attention.
Yeah. Usually it's me with the cats in the background.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, so maybe next
well,
time.
Well, it's been a very interesting talk.
Yeah, next time let's get back and talk about some esoteric and let's talk about the head doctrine and the heart doctrine a bit.
Yeah, it's been funny. I felt so disheartened lately by the world situation, the kind of impossibility of doing anything. You know, going downtown to this SPP thing, and there was no one there, you know. I walked up to Parliament Hill, and there was a group from Syria protesting, and I talked to a man. I went up and asked him what it was about. He had been in a Syrian jail for 12 years.
Oh, my God.
He's telling me that the dictator there had hung 25,000 people, and he showed me the marks of his torture on them.
Wow.
So that was Syria, and just another wonderful Hasnam.
Assad. Yeah,
it's just unbelievable.
Very bad person.
we're lucky that so far. I mean, I think the karma's coming down upon North America. I think we're going to face these things ourselves now. I think it's part of our karma.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of what's going to happen. Hopefully not. Hopefully things will be turned around. I think the U.S. is looking for a new false flag terrorist thing to, you know, justify another war against Iran. I'm glad they've held off, and hopefully will, you know, hopefully someone will restrain the dogs of war.
Yeah.
Anyway, so a pretty disturbing world situation. As Gurdjieff says, the mass, we think the world is run by conscious people. Where are they? Who are they? In fact, we see exactly the opposite. And it's really quite horrifying.
Yeah.
So we do need to keep faith and remember ourselves, not to lose heart. Thanks, Jim.
Okay, Chris. Yeah.
Thanks, CBS.
Well, that was a cheery talk.
Yeah, really.